Morning, everyone. Welcome back to the second day of this weekend of the presentation of tenets. So, of course, this weekend we're looking at the second two philosophical systems of Cittamatra and the Madhyamika. And then we're in the middle of the Cittamatra system at the moment. And again, before we launch back into that, we'll start with a meditation. Of course, Cittamatra usually is translated as mind only in English. Everything's the nature of the mind. So in sort of parallel with that, this meditation is we're going to do, of course, a meditation where we prepare the body and mind, and then we'll actually rest in the mind itself, resting in awareness itself. So this is a shamatha practice, of course, just being aware of being aware, not paying any attention to any appearances. So we'll do that for a little while, and then towards the end we'll set a good motivation for today. So let's start with that meditation, and then we'll go back into the text. So letting go of any external distractions and allowing the awareness to descend into the body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And in particular, relaxing all the muscles in the face. The eyes soft and relaxed. And again, we can take three slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And then allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. and then preparing the mind, setting it into a state of ease and relaxation, letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns, and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And then allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. The eyes soft and relaxed. And then release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. Now all sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. Of course, not blocking the appearance, but also not engaging in the appearance. And simply focus on being aware of being aware. you're finding that you're tense, agitated, or perhaps caught up in appearances, then use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax and release awareness, releasing all appearances. Or if you're finding that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus, being aware of being aware. In this way, balancing the mind, being relaxed and alert. Resting in luminously clear awareness. then let's spend the last few minutes reflecting on our motivation for coming here today and setting the best possible motivation. And if you can, include others in your motivation, that you're also doing this in order to benefit others. I know nothing.
That's a successful meditation. That was a successful meditation.
Oh, yeah. I think that's right. Probably in his office, yeah. So let's begin with a short review before we move on. So this text we're following, Presentation of Tenets by Jetson Chegi Gyaltsen, who's actually the, as I mentioned, the textbook writer for the Sarah J. Monastic College within the Gelug School. There are a number of other commentators within some of the other schools within the Gelug, and sometimes there is even there differences of opinion. Like often there's another well-known writer called Panchen Sonam Drakpa. And he, and contemporary to Jetson Chegi Gyaltsen, and there is often, you see that there is some differences of opinion there and different assertions, some fairly subtle and sometimes not so subtle. So even within the Gelug school, there are differences of opinion. So of course, then within the various Tibetan schools, there will be some differences of opinion. And some of that comes a little bit from perspective that they adopt. Particularly in the Gluck school, until you get into really the highest level, into Tantra, they have the perspective of being an ordinary person and looking forward on the spiritual path. You know, in the Gluck school, we have Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. So it's like, here I am now, there's the goal of enlightenment. What stages do I have to go through to get there? So they have this perspective looking forward on the path. Whereas particularly in the Kagyu and Nyingma school, due to the style of their practice, Mahamudra Dzogchen, they, even from the very beginning, adopt the complete opposite perspective. They're adopting the perspective of the enlightened state and viewing their practice from that state. And so that reflects in, particularly here we're talking about the Chittamatra assertions, which are coming from the third turning of the wheel. And so in that third turning wheel, I briefly mentioned there's another part of the third turning wheel called Buddha nature. And so that is very much reflected in what I've been just saying within that topic of Buddha nature. Is, again, because the Gluck perspective is looking forward, when we look at that Buddha nature, it's usually presented in the Gluck as a potential for enlightenment, i.e. the emptiness of the mind, if we want to be specific. Because the mind is empty of inherent existence, therefore we have the potential for enlightenment. Whereas in the Kagyu Nyingma, who adopt the opposite perspective, Buddha nature is not a potential. Buddha nature is, there is a Buddha within. We only need to unveil the Buddha that was there from the very beginning. And to really understand that they're actually two valid perspectives of the same thing. We, analogy we can give is a window. Let's say it's dirty. We can have two perspectives. We can say, there's a dirty window. We need to put effort to produce a clean window. And that's normally the perspective we adopt. But equally well, we could have a perspective, actually, there's already a clean window there. We just need to remove the dirt to manifest the clean window that was there from the very beginning. So they're not contradictory, are they? They're two different perspectives of the same thing. And so, therefore, some of the differences you'll find within the Tibetan schools come because of that difference in perspective. And so if you don't understand that, superficially you go, wow, they disagree completely. But often the case is, and sometimes they do disagree on some little technical point, but sometimes it's simply perspective, that because of the different perspective, then we have those seemingly very contradictory presentations. And so that comes up with a little bit what we'll be covering today and tomorrow a little bit, this idea of definitive and interpretive. And we find that within the Chittamatra versus the Majjhimika, and even Svatantrika versus Prasangika, comes in terms of their view, in terms of perspective, in terms of then what's definitive and what's interpretive. So, therefore, even within the Gluck schools, there's some differences, and sometimes they are actual technical differences, and sometimes they're slightly different perspectives, and certainly within the Tibetan traditions. And then if you go outside of that, of course, into the other Mahayana traditions, I think they will talk about this sort of Chittamatra and the Majjhimika views and stuff, but they also may have different, slightly different perspective, but also maybe some slightly different views about that. Because remember, it's all interpretation. So even the great Indian masters, following from Nagarjuna, who talked about Buddha's idea of emptiness from the second turning of the wheel, even among those great Indian masters, there was disagreements about what that meant. Yeah. And sometimes, of course, when we're interpreting the Buddha's teachings or some earlier master's view, it's our interpretation, or the person who's doing it's their interpretation. Yeah. So you're going to find different ideas coming out. And so this is one, the presentation that's coming through initially the Tibetan system, the Gluk system, and then within the Sarah J. College. So yes, there will be some differences, of course. It's the nature of hermeneutics, of being able to interpret, of course. And of course, the bottom line is that no matter what presentation we see, it's not to sort of gobble up and accept everything on face value. I mean, we are to be like all the previous masters. We are to investigate that, you know. We're to look at that and say, well, does that make sense? And is that helpful or not? So it's not a matter of believing everything and going, yeah, this guy got it right and I believe everything they say. I mean, that's not going to be very helpful for us. We have to look at that and see whether it makes sense and whether it's useful for us, and then use that in that way. Okay, so let's go to the Chittamatra. So from this book again, just to give a little summary of Chittamatra, and then we'll talk about some of the points we've covered yesterday before moving on. And in here it says, and this is from the actual authors, Daniel Kozel, Craig Preston. This is what they've summarized as Chittamatra. He says, Chittamatra is a term applied to those who take literally the teaching in the Sandina Moccha Sutra. So this is a sutra that's coming in the third turning of the wheel. And some other places that there is nothing external to consciousness, i.e. that the world is mind only, i.e. Chittamatra. Some are called followers of reasoning because, like their Sautrantika counterparts, they rely on the works of Dignaga and Dharmakirti. The others are, of course, followers of scripture. They follow the works of Asanga and Vasubandhu. And here in brackets it says, Asanga converted his half-brother Vasubandhu to the Mahayana. Hence, Vasubandhu is an important source for three of the four main schools, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, and Chittamatra. So we saw that already, that initially he wrote Abhidharma Kosha according to reflect the Vaibhashika view. Then his commentary on his own text, he wrote it according to Sautrantika view, or reflecting that. And then he was sort of converted to Chittamatra by his brother Asanga. And so some of his later texts were critical of those positions, and thereby he established the Chittamatra view, or was in line with the Chittamatra view. The most significant of their differences from the Sautrantikas is that they reject the existence of external objects. Also, the followers of reasoning argue that all persons eventually become a Buddha, a teaching known as one final vehicle. That's something we're going to be coming up to shortly. So let's have a look at what we've covered so far in the Chittamatra section. So we saw in the definition that they're propounding Mahayana tenets. So like the Majjhimika, which is the next section we're going to look in the text, Mahayana tenets is really meaning that there is very much a distinction between nirvana and enlightenment. That to achieve nirvana, liberation from samsara, we have to eliminate what's called the afflictive obscuration. So all schools are in agreement with this. However, in the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system, they clearly identify that actually to achieve the goal of enlightenment, to become a Buddha, is a further goal, and we need to eliminate what's called the cognitive obscurations. So therefore, we're really talking about the Mahayana tenets here. And most of these philosophical systems would agree, although there's one subschool in Chittamatra that doesn't, everyone can achieve the goal of enlightenment, become a Buddha, and that we can eliminate these two obscurations. So they said that they do not assert external objects, but does accept truly existent self-cognition. So they are one of the schools that talk about this self-cognition, which we've looked at in some detail already. The divisions here, true aspectarians, false aspectarians. Another way of dividing Chittamatra, of course, as I briefly mentioned, were followers of scripture, followers of reasoning. Here, true aspectarian, false aspectarian is talking about a difference of assertion in terms of whether things that appear as gross forms, whether that is a true appearance or that is also polluted by ignorance, that appearance. So all Chittamatrans, of course, are say the appearance of things as being external is an appearance polluted by ignorance. So they're all uniform in that. But the true aspectarians say that actually the appearance of things as gross objects is true. There's no ignorance or pollution going on there. Whereas the false aspectarians say that actually the appearance of things as a gross object is polluted by ignorance, because their assertion is that if that was a true appearance, that would actually imply that that gross object is actually external. So for them, they say even the appearance of something as a gross object, like a flower, that is polluted by ignorance. So that's the sort of differences there. And then if we go on to over the page, on page 14, etymology, of course, chittamatra, mind only, everything is the nature of the mind. Therefore, refuting that there is an external reality, even though there appears to be an external material world, that world is not existing as it appears. So that's, remember, emptiness for them. Emptiness is the fact that the world of appearances are empty of being external. Another way of saying that, of course, is no subject-object duality in that sense, or that the consciousness and the form that it apprehends are empty of being different substances, meaning there's no internal consciousness and external physical reality. They're not different substances, because the actual physical, the world out there is actually the nature of the mind. It appears to be material, but it's not. It's mental.
Could we say that's why those two are simultaneously?
Yeah, and so part of that assertion, and we saw that briefly there, there's a number of reasonings they use to refute external reality. You know, the refuting of the partless particles, the analogy of a dream, example of three different types of beings looking in the same place, seeing three different things. And similarly, the idea of perceiving things simultaneously, that even in the Buddha's teaching, sometimes he says that, you know, we apprehend things in the present moment, meaning that that appearance and the awareness apprehending it are arising simultaneously. That, of course, would be impossible if there is a physical external world, because that would be the cause. They would be serial. There first would be the appearance from the external world producing a consciousness apprehending it. And so they then quote a number of the Buddha's teachings where he says simultaneous. And so they say, therefore, that can't be external, that actually they're arising simultaneously from, as we saw yesterday, from the same imprint in the mind. That imprint ripens as the subject and object simultaneously. So that's another reasoning they use to refute external objects. And then in terms of objects here, we talk about conventional truth and ultimate truth. And so there we saw that the ultimate truth here is emptiness. There are a couple of synonyms for that. Final reality, sphere of reality, which in Sanskrit is dhammata or dhammadhatu. And here we talk about ultimate truths, that there are two divisions of ultimate truth, selfnesses of person, selfnesses of phenomena. So selfnesses of person is, like the lower schools, a lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. And selfnesses of phenomena is, they're the two given there, but basically they amount to the same thing, is that the selfness of phenomena is the emptiness of phenomena being external to the mind. They're not different substances. There's not an internal mind and an external physical world. So that's emptiness or selfnesses of phenomena for them. And then if we looked at conventional truth, we see that conventional truths are divided into these other power phenomena and these imputational constructs. So therefore we talked about these three natures, that the other powered nature or dependent nature
Yeah. So the literal way of translating in the text is other-powered. That is the actual literal translation. But other-powered, of course, means it comes into existence through the power of other things, meaning it comes through into existence through the power of causes and conditions. Therefore, it's a dependent phenomena, depending on causes and conditions. And then the imputed constructs or the imputational constructs, and then we have the thoroughly established nature, the ultimate nature, and of course this is talking about emptiness. So here in the imputed constructs, we can talk about ones that exist, i.e. that fact that we label or impute flower on this basis that is other-powered. But the one we're really interested here is the non-existent imputed nature, and that is we also impute that this is an external flower. It exists external to the mind. So for Chittamatra, that is a non-existent, that imputation, that labelling of that being external to the mind. So that is the thoroughly established nature, or the ultimate nature of things, is that this imputed nature of it being external does not exist in that basis. So that is another way of saying emptiness or the thoroughly established nature, that everything, that these phenomena lack being that. There's no external flower within that basis. It's empty of that. So that is another way of talking about emptiness. So these are the three natures. And then we also saw that the sense objects, if we look on page 15, talked about are being produced on the basis of a substance that is an inner consciousness, independence upon latencies of common and uncommon actions deposited upon the mind basis of all. They are not established as external objects. So we saw then that the mechanism for Chittamatran is that even though this appears to be external to the mind, what's actually happening is that we have imprints in our mind, particularly they say that are deposited on the mind basis of all, this eighth consciousness, and that what happens is in every experience that an imprint will ripen simultaneously as the object and the subject. And so that's what this is saying here. Therefore, this object, which appears to be external and physical, is not, because it is a ripening of this imprint on the mind basis of all as the object and the subject simultaneously. So they say this is actually what's going on. So let's now go on to the fifth outline, is where we left off, I think. So again, just to reaffirm those two differences between the true aspectarian and false aspectarian, we see just before that outline, it says, according to true aspectarians, even though the five sense objects, form and so forth, are not external objects, they are asserted to exist as gross objects. So again, true aspectarian is saying that this appearance as a gross object, as a flower, is true, that there's no distortion there. But the false aspectarians, as we see here, it says, according to false aspectarians, the five sense objects, forms, and so forth, are not gross objects, because if they were gross objects, they would necessarily be external objects. So that's why false aspectarians say that actually even this appearing as a gross object is polluted by ignorance, because if it wasn't, it would necessarily imply that flower would actually be an external object. So,
what's the reason that
just well, they say there's no problem with, they don't see a contradiction between that appearing as a gross object in a true way and not being external. Of course, they would argue, each one would say to the other, your position is illogical. I think I didn't see any particular more reasoning in that. They're just saying that according to their way of thinking, if it would appear as a gross object, that would necessarily imply it would be external. Whereas the false aspectarians
The true aspectarians wouldn't say that, wouldn't accept that. That's all. So let's go on to the fifth outline, the object possessors. So here, remember, in each of the outlines of the four skills, when we talk about object possessors or subjects, the first thing they talk about, the person. What's the illustration of the person? So as we saw in our chart here, the four Buddhist tenet systems chart is all Buddhist tenet systems. And for that fact, any system that talks about continuity from life to life has to posit what is that continuity. And so that's what we're talking about here in the illustration of the person. And we see different assertions. And so here, if we look at the first sentence in outline five, it says, true aspectarians. And here, I think, as I mentioned yesterday, in this text, there are two ways of dividing Chittamatrans, either as followers of scripture and followers of reasoning, or true aspectarians, false aspectarians. In this text, they say that there's no direct correlation between those ways of dividing. However, here, the way he's written it seems to imply that basically true aspectarians are followers of scripture and false aspectarians are followers of reasoning. That's how it's written. It's evident because here he says true aspectarians assert eight collections of consciousness. In the other way of dividing, followers of scripture, followers of sanghas, and followers of Dharmakirti, it's only the followers of a sangha that posit this. So there really does seem to be this correlation here in this text. So the eight collections of consciousness is, again, a presentation that comes within the followers of sangha, that a sangha who really was the originator of the Chittamatra system in the 4th century, talked about eight consciousnesses. So, of course, the normal presentation we see when we talk about consciousness, we see six consciousnesses. Is we have the five sense consciousnesses, of course, and mental consciousness. So this is the normal presentation within most of the Buddhist philosophical systems. And this, of course, is the presentation that we see that Dharmakirti provides. And so the followers of reasoning, or here the false aspectarians, would have that as their presentation. And that's the presentation we use in the Prasangika, in the Sautrantika and so forth. However, within the followers of scripture, the followers of the Sangha, they posit two more consciousnesses. Because they say here that they accept, in addition to the six consciousnesses asserted by other proponents of tenets, adding the mind basis of all and afflicted mentality make eight. And one of the reasons they add these two is this idea of continuity. You know, the illustration of person, particularly in terms of then karmic imprints. There needs to be continuity. And one of the arguments they use to substantiate this is that these consciousnesses are not always present. You know, that sometimes we're in deep sleep and sometimes the sense consciousness is not operating, so forth. And so they say that then to talk about just that, there's some problem with that, difficulty with saying there's continuity. So then they particularly posit this mind basis of all. In Sanskrit, is alaya vijnana, sometimes translated as storehouse consciousness, foundational consciousness, substrate consciousness,
It's given a number of different ways of translating it. Because they say that this is this consciousness that has this continuity. It's always present, and it's only really functioning as a depository for the karmic imprints. And then the afflicted mentality, in fact, we'll read the descriptions of them and then we'll talk about them a bit more. It says, there are illustrations of both the mind basis of all and the afflicted mentality. The consciousness that is an object different from the six conscious collections of consciousness and does not depend upon a sense power, because all these six consciousnesses, for them to be generated, require a sense power, a sense faculty, either the five sense faculties or the mental faculty. But here, the mind basis of all doesn't need that. Does not depend upon sense power, that it's its own uncommon empowering condition, is asserted to be mind basis of all. The consciousness that observes the mind basis of all, its observed object, and apprehends it in an aspect of being a self-sufficient, substantially existent I, is accepted to be afflicted mentality. So the mind basis of all is accepted to be the illustration of the person that is the support for actions and results. So actions and results, of course, is karma. So the mind basis of all is thereby posited as a consciousness that is always present, and it's actually the basis for the karmic imprint, so we have continuity, and also therefore in terms of person, because it's always present, there is person present all the time. There's a continuity of person. So this is what they assert, and then they assert that the afflicted mentality, of course, then is grasping onto that as a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So then they posit this extra afflicted mentality as the aspect of the mind that is this ignorance that we need to eliminate. So they add these two to sort of give a presentation for them that is more logical and appropriate to what we're talking about here. So this is the presentation that we find with the followers of Scripture, anyone who's following a Sangha.
I just wanted to guess, do you mean like there's a afflicted mentality which looks at substantial resistance for the mind versus a whole?
Yeah, that's what it says here. It says the consciousness that observes the mind basis of all, its observed object, and apprehends it in an aspect of it being self-sufficient, substantially existent I, is accepted to be the afflicted mentality.
Why can't the mental consciousness be an afflicted mentality?
And exactly this is the reasoning the other schools say, why do you need to talk about that? Exactly.
I'll get back to you.
Yeah. And that's why... See, but again, the followers of Sangha find difficulty with just that, because they say, well, where's this continuity, you know? If we're talking about continuity of person and karmic imprints, these are not always manifest, so you've lost your continuity here.
So the afflicted mentality is continuity, which the mental consciousness doesn't.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but certainly the mind basis of all. And then because they assert this to be person, then they assert this afflicted mentality as the aspect of the mind that is grasping that in the wrong way.
Yeah.
Why they actually add that as well...
I was wondering whether the mental consciousness can't grasp in the wrong way.
Well, of course, the other schools say that's exactly what happens. Of course. So I think this presentation is to really understand the mechanisms of the process of how, where we go wrong and so forth.
I mean, mind-based.
Yeah, but I mean, again, Prasangikas, as we're going to see, refute, they say, we don't need to talk about this. This is, you know.
But they put it into mental consciousness. So basically, they don't say that it doesn't exist. It's just part of kind of mental consciousness.
Remember, the Chittamatrans say that this is, as we see here, it says that it's an object different from the six collections of consciousness. So that's something different than the six collections of consciousness for the Chittamatrans. Yeah. So the Prasangikas would say we don't need to posit the existence of such a thing because we can explain everything. We can explain the continuity of person, the idea of karma, based just on this presentation. So this is...
So if I understand well, Prasangika says that this mind base is a world, so this continuity is there, but it's not separate from mental consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, they would say we don't need to talk about that
exactly.
In, for continuity. Yeah.
Yes, sometimes
you
say, continuity of mind.
Right.
Is there such a thing, really? Because is a continuity, dependent on time? Isn't there always a gap? Isn't there always a continuity?
Right.
Isn't there always a gap between, isn't it just, I thought consciousness existed moment by moment.
Ah.
So,
see.
Which means that there's a gap, which means it exists within the consciousness.
Yeah, so often, and again, this is where Prasangika would actually sort of be a little bit critical of some of these presentations because they lead us to think in this way. So the normal presentation of impermanence, and this is coming from Sautrantika, is momentary phenomena. That there's things that are changing moment by moment. So when we hear that, we think, okay, we have a moment here, something's existing in this moment, and in the next moment, it changes to something else. And then in the next moment, it changes to something else. Is that really what's going on? Certainly from a Prasangika, but even from a lower school perspective, this idea of impermanence is completely false. This can't work. In fact, some of the reasonings that Nagarjuna has in his Mula Madhyamika in the 2nd century refute this idea. They say, you believe in this? What about this? And then we end up in this sort of logical absurdity. Because even from a... If we forget about Buddhist philosophy, if we just go into science and physics, is this what's really going on? In the phenomenal world?
Well, isn't the gap where the change can happen?
Well, that's the point. See, this is the whole point, is that if we understand impermanence at a deeper level, this idea is completely false. Because if we talk about a moment, we're talking about a duration of time, aren't we?
Yeah.
Whatever that may be. So there's a duration of time, very small, where it's not changing. That's illogical, isn't it? So if we talk about a moment of time where there is a thing existing, that's completely illogical. Because then we're saying that thing for that duration of time is not changing. But that's opposite to the definition of impermanent phenomena. So we cannot have, however small, a moment of time where things are not changing. So this idea of impermanence is completely wrong. It's useful as a simple mechanism to understand change, but then we have to go deeper and understand that's not impermanence like this. Impermanence is that. That there's just constant change. So when we talk about moments, that's a useful concept for us to get our head around it. But if we grasp onto that as real and for that duration it's not changing, and then then it changes in the next moment, this is false. This can't be true. This is impossible. So therefore we need to understand that momentary change is a concept to understand that things are not static. But to really understand that, we have to really appreciate that we're not saying that for a small period of time called a moment, that thing is not changing. And then suddenly, instantly, it changes into something else that stays static for a short moment. That's impossible. So that's not what we're saying when we talk about momentary change. change. This is not really what's going on. Yeah.
Therefore,
if we understand that momentary change is not sort of that, but this, and we realize this impermanence, we're this close to realizing emptiness according to Prasangika. This close. In fact, Prasangika would say that if you really realize impermanence, it's the same as emptiness. Because then if there's not this, then there's never any distinct phenomena existing from its own side. Because there's only change. Then you can't point to anything and say, well, there it is, which is the Prasangika view. All lower schools don't agree with that. Because all lower schools below Prasangika say for something to exist, it must be findable. So the lower schools don't see any real contradiction with this idea.
Okay. So the plot thickens. We're getting closer to Prasangika. So let's have a look at this assertions, these six consciousnesses and eight consciousness. Just read a little bit from here, try and clarify a little bit more. So this is on page 195. And he's talking here about mind basis of all and afflicted mentality. And this is quoting from the actual tenets text by Jungyam Shaper, who says, "The mind basis of all is a non-defiled and neutral mind. It is subtle, hidden, and that which possesses all seeds," meaning karmic imprints. "Regarding the mind basis of all, its entity is non-defiled and it is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. Therefore, it is a non-defiled and neutral. It is a mind, but its mode of perception is difficult to ascertain, and it is difficult by those of weak mind to recognize it. Therefore, it is subtle and hidden. It serves as the basis of all seeds that are deposited by virtue, etc. The afflicted mind possesses the quality of being a mind that, observing that mind basis of all, thinks I. The afflicted mind is an awareness possessing many qualifications that, having observed that mind basis of all, thinks I and mine. The followers of Brothers Asanga and Vasubandhu assert eight collections of consciousnesses." And now here's Dharmakirti, who doesn't accept that. It says, "Because of not explaining a mind basis of all on suitable occasions, and because two conceptual consciousnesses do not occur simultaneously, the systems of the followers of Dharmakirti's seven treatises on valid cognition assert six collections of consciousnesses, not eight." And the reasoning, some of the reasoning that he uses, Dignaga and Dharmakirti, is, it says, some of the reasons here is that Dharmakirti did not explain that there were more than six types of consciousnesses on many occasions when they should have spoken if they did assert a mind basis of all. And Dharmakirti said that two conceptual consciousnesses do not arise simultaneously. And Dharmakirti explained that conceptual consciousnesses are understood to operate serially. So that's some of the reasonings they use. Okay. No, they say that actually to assert them in the Chittamatran's way is illogical, and they can't exist in the way that Chittamatran's have posited them. Yeah, the mind basis of all, of course, is simultaneous with the conscious, because it's always there, because it's it's the continuity of person, it's the basis for all the seeds. So it's simultaneous, and one of the reasons he used is you can't have two mental consciousnesses simultaneous. Not really, because not in that sense. It's not really a self-knower. But it has a similar operation in that it only is inwardly directed in that sense, yes. Grasping mind basis of all. So they use this afflicted mentality as a way of describing the grasping onto self. But again, the other schools would say, well, we don't really need to talk about that. You know, it's just the mental consciousness is grasping onto self. That's all.
How would they then debate then those points in Chittamatra? They would say, like, whatever is mind basis of this consciousness?
Well, the reasoning for mind basis of all is the fact that we need a continuity of person, and they see fault in saying that something in the six consciousnesses is the person. Because most of the schools say the mental consciousness is the illustration of person. And they say, well, that can't be true, because sometimes mental consciousness is not manifest. So then you'd have to say sometimes there's no person. So they say, well, there's a problem there, isn't there? So then they posit, oh, we don't have a problem because mind basis of all is always there. So we're okay. Your position is illogical. That's what they would say to the people who assert six consciousnesses. That's their reasoning.
So the problem is just that there's nothing wrong with mind basis of all. The problem is
with the effect of the mentality. Sure. Again, the mind basis of all, as we saw here, is a neutral mind, and it's merely the place to deposit seeds. Yeah, the afflicted mentality is doing the grasping. So that's the thing that they're saying, that this is the thing that kicks off the whole samsara, that this afflicted mentality is grasping that mind basis of all, self-sufficient. Okay, let's move on then. So the mind basis of all is accepted to be the illustration of the person that is the support for actions and results. So, of course, this is only the assertion of the followers of scripture, or here the true aspectarians. So again, if we look on the four Buddhist tenet systems chart for Chittamatra, the illustration of person is mind basis of all for the followers of scripture and followers of reasoning. Following Dharmakirti, of course, like many of the other schools, they posit the mental consciousness to be the illustration of the person. So we see that here also in the next sentence. False aspectarians accept six collections of consciousness and posit the mere mental consciousness to be the illustration of the person that is support for actions and their results. So again, in this text, it really does very much to seem that the true aspectarians are correlated with the followers of scripture, and the false aspectarians are correlated with the followers of reasoning. Remember, though, the followers of scripture, who this is correlated with, arose first in the 4th century Surya Sangha. Followers of reasoning only came 3 centuries later, in the 7th century, through Dharmakirti.
Yeah, I was just making the point that the true aspectarians, whether they're synonymous with...
Yeah, sure.
They seem to have come up with something a little bit different, quite different to all the other...
Because the that's right. So it could be, as you said, then, because it came later, maybe it's a more influence, and therefore there's a refinement of this. And so maybe the original view with the followers of scripture felt it necessary to posit these things to substantiate the idea that there's no external objects. And maybe a later refinement through Dharmakirti is, well, we can still talk about no external objects. We don't need to talk about mind basis of all to substantiate these things. Perhaps. I'm just speculating.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that it's not about
the same. Sure, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Right, a couple of more minutes, so let's move on and then we'll have a morning tea break. The proponents of Chittamatra accept 2 types of awareness, valid cognition and non-valid cognition. So like all the schools, there's valid cognition, non-valid cognition. And I think here also with the Chittamatra, valid cognition is necessarily new, as with the other schools, that the second moment is not a valid cognition, it's a subsequent cognition. So there are 2 types of valid cognition, valid perception and valid inference. Again, similar to the other schools. There are 4 types of perception. So because they accept self-cognizer, that's the 4th. So the 3, of course, are sense, mental and yogic perception. So pretty well all the schools accept those, that there's sense perception, there's mental perception, which generally is this just one moment of mental perception following a sense perception. Also, we could also talk about mental perception in terms of directly knowing someone's mind, so clairvoyance and so forth. There's also a type of mental perception. And then, of course, yogic perception is when we come to realize the nature of reality, depending on the school, what that is. But here, of course, they also talk about this self-cognizer, which is also a type of direct perception. So it says here, self-cognizing perception and yogic perception are necessarily non-mistaken consciousnesses. So actually, there's something that comes out of this. Well, self-cognizing perception is fairly obvious that it's non-mistaken, but it says yogic perception is necessarily non-mistaken consciousnesses. So if we look over the page, we see there's four types of yogic perception. There is yogic perception directly realizing subtle impermanence, realizing subtle selfnesses of person, coarse selfnesses of person, and realizing selfnesses of phenomena. So the assertion is that yogic perception is necessarily non-mistaken. Does anyone see any implications with that and this four types of yogic perception? Wouldn't it be if an ordinary person, i.e. someone who's not realized emptiness, if they directly realize subtle impermanence, wouldn't that be mistaken? Because isn't the impermanence they're realizing appearing to be external? Or if you're realizing, if an ordinary person realized selfness as a person, there's no self-sufficient person, wouldn't that still be appearing to be external? So wouldn't it be mistaken? So what I'm saying is that the fact that the Chittamatrans assert that yogic perception is necessarily unmistaken implies that only Arya beings who realized emptiness realize directly subtle impermanence, subtle selfness, coarse selfness as a person. That's the implication. And actually, it's only in the Prasangika school where they don't accept that. Also, we're going to find in Svatantrika, they would also say only an Arya being, i.e. someone who's realized emptiness directly, has a realization, a direct realization of impermanence or selfness as a person. Whereas the Prasangikas, as we're going to see, are different in that they say an ordinary person can directly realize subtle impermanence and selfness as a person. But that's the implication here. No. Well, that's the implication. Because they say yogic perception is necessarily non-mistaken. Which means the implication is an ordinary person can't have a direct realization. Because a direct realization of impermanence is a yogic perception. But if that was in the continuum of a normal person who hasn't realized emptiness, that would be mistaken. Because it would still appear to be external. So that's the implication, and that's what we find in the tenets, actually. For Chittamatra and Svatantrika, these direct realizations of impermanence and selfness as a person only happen in the continuum of someone who's directly realized emptiness, which for me sounds a bit strange, but that's their assertion. Whereas in the Majjhimika, an ordinary person who's not realized emptiness can have a direct realization of selfness as a person or, as is defined here, or impermanence. So that's just a little bit of a subtle difference. And on that note, it's time for a tea break. So let's have a morning tea break and